This project was a good project, and when people ask, what's your most interesting project, this is the one I usually pop up. You've always got to have an interesting one to talk about when you're talking to people. So, I live in Spokane, and I happen to be able to do some work for the airport as a consultant. We're a northern climate, unlike Arizona here, but it surprised me to see that as we pulled in, I noticed that there were some de-icing trucks here in Phoenix even. I had no idea that they would use de-icer here in Phoenix in the desert. But we get about 16 inches of precipitation a year, 42 inches of snowfall annually. Aircraft need de-icing when ice forms. When frost forms on the wings, they need to remove it before the plane leaves, otherwise it affects the flight surfaces. Everybody wants to fly, and if your lift is affected by ice, that hinders your ability to fly. Anti-icing is another different product, but it's a similar formulation that is applied before you fly. It sticks to the wings a little bit better, but it's still all propylene glycol. Propylene glycol has a very high chemical oxygen demand. Now, a lot of people think of de-icing or antifreeze as ethylene glycol. Ethylene glycol is toxic to a lot of living things, and they've switched to propylene glycol for the last 15 years or so. So it's safer for your dog to drink. But it's a very high chemical oxygen demand. It's about 14 pounds of chemical oxygen demand per gallon of liquid. And just for perspective, a gallon of propylene glycol weighs about 8.7 pounds. So it's like candy to the microbes. The stormwater at this particular place infiltrates into an area at the end of the runways and creates anaerobic and reducing conditions in the groundwater. Matter of fact, the groundwater was actually a little fizzy at one point in time. And we measured that, and there was methane and CO2 in that fizz. So it mobilizes iron and manganese and arsenic in the groundwater. Arsenic is detectable at low levels, and the iron is at about 30 to 40 parts per million, and the manganese is somewhere in the 7 to 15 parts per million. So it's a little bit more than drinking water standards. So their stormwater permit, we had a call to action to help protect the groundwater quality, and most of the concentrated focus has been on arsenic, but iron and manganese as well are a problem. So we worked out an adaptive management program to stepwise go through the process of trying to resolve the issue, because you don't want to just jump at it and avoid a simple solution that will help solve the problem. So we started with pollution prevention and collection and treatment. The whole focus is, let's try to keep the propylene glycol out of the stormwater that's discharged to the infiltration area. So the first step was how much aircraft de-icing fluids are being used and what's our progress in controlling their use. You don't want to limit their use. It's at the discretion of the pilots on whether it's used or not and how much is used, because we all want our airplanes to stay in the air. But they went through a process of adjusting the de-icing locations. They used to de-ice right at the gate, and so now instead of focusing on a de-icing pad, they're actually moving the aircraft away from the gate to a common location to de-ice in various near each terminal, and then trying to avoid de-icing over the trench drains that take the storm water out and things like that to try to control the location of the de-icing. I looked at collection alternatives from all the way from collecting what's spilled on the ground with a modified vacuum truck called a glycol recovery vehicle to collecting all the storm water at the end of the pipe. Obviously, you don't want to have to collect all the stormwater at the end of the pipe, because that's a lot of water. If you can collect it at the source and do a little pollution prevention, early collection is preferred. So the first step was to use GRVs, glycol recovery vehicles, to recover the de-icer from the overspray and the drippings off the aircraft. treatment. We looked at all kinds of different treatment options, and treatment options vary with the amount of recovered de-icer that you have to deal with, whether you're collecting all the storm water or whether you're collecting it at the source in a concentrated form. The first step was to collect it with the glycol recovery vehicles in a more concentrated form from the spots where it was applied, and evaluate. And at first it was fairly concentrated, and they could sell it for recycling to a recycler who would haul it to Wyoming and redistill it and sell it as RV antifreeze and antifreeze in heating and cooling systems, just a fluid to control the to pull the cold or the warm air through. But as the concentration went below about 15%, the hauler said that's hauling too much water and we don't want to mess with that. But for a fee, we could take care of this for you. So then we went and implemented a land treatment program, and that's really what we're talking about, using the soil as the treatment process as we continue to collect the glycol and with the GRVs. Now, a little bit about the composition of the recovered de-icer. It's about 20 to 30% propylene glycol. We first had to go to the literature, and a nice paper by Castro from Kansas back in about 2000 was very instrumental in helping us identify what's in it, because all these other things, the benzotriazole, the corrosion inhibitors, the surfactants, viscosity enhancers, and other additives, they're proprietary. Try to get that from Dow or the other makers of the ADF, and it's a little difficult. So testing is required. So we did some testing on the recovered de-icer before we started and after we began. And the things that we found was we ranged from about 12 to 25% propylene glycol. COD was about 180 to 218,000 milligrams per liter, which is a little bit stiff. So the corrosion inhibitors, about 21 milligrams per liter, and the molybdenum, which was a surprise to me, we had some molybdenum at 5 to 9 milligrams per liter, and it seems to vary with the glycol concentration, so I think it's something to do with the formulation of the propylene glycol aircraft de-icing fluid. Total petroleum hydrocarbons from spilled fuel, leaked oil, whatever, on the tarmac is about 44 to 119 milligrams per liter, something to keep track of. Total nitrogen about 12 to 31. Total phosphorus about 3 to 9. Potassium and sodium, you wonder where that came from. Well, they actually use other pavement de-icers, solid and liquid pavement de-icers, for the walking areas and on the runways, because they're not going to spray aircraft de-icing fluid on the runway when it snows. That just gets slippery and slick. So it's the sodium and potassium formates or the sodium potassium acetate that they use to as de-icers. And the electrical conductivity was quite high. Matter of fact, the sodium was high enough that the SAR was in the neighborhood of between 40 and 60. So we looked at the limiting constituent, and the limiting factor for land application was, ta-da, the COD treatment capacity of the soil. Go figure. So we determined the oxygen diffusion rate using the soil porosity and the drainage rate. We first characterized the soil out at the site, ran bulk density, soil texture, described the soils, looked at the nitrogen, pH, salinity, and the we used the EPA method that was really first described by McKee back in the 1960s and modified by Overcash and Powell and others in the 1980s to look at re-aeration rate and porosity, because that's your ability to treat. That's your ability to get oxygen into the soil to treat the oxygen demand. So as we turned this in, we talked to the Department of Ecology and said, well, you haven't adjusted for the altitude and the oxygen content in the atmosphere. So we adjusted for the altitude, which wasn't much of an adjustment, at 2,300 feet elevation. And I also modified the formula for the Q10 because of temperature. We're not going to be applying in perfect temperatures all the time, and I wanted to see what the change in reactive time would be for that treatment capacity. Figured the minimum treatment capacity, as it turned out, was about 150 pounds per acre per day. Seems pretty reasonable, but that's from April through October when the temperatures are favorable for growing things. But also figured on 150 pounds per acre per day isn't much to apply when your COD is at 200,000. So we looked at how much could we apply at one time in one dose and came up with 1,050 pounds per acre per day in 7 days. We don't get a whole lot of torrential rains, so we're not worried about after you apply it, the rainfall washing this through, and the fact that the soil is a sponge and not a sieve makes all the difference in the world. We created an application rate guidance because it's not going to be rocket scientists supplying this stuff. And we used, to try to figure out the glycol concentration, we used the refractants of the refractometer to calculate the Brix, and then that's directly related to the glycol concentration, which can be converted into COD pounds per gallon, which then can be applied at gallons per acre, depending on the concentration, because the concentration tends to vary a little bit as you go through the tank of glycol that's recovered. And this was just a matrix that I put together for the applicators and for the engineering report that we supplied to the Department of Ecology to get this approved. Now, the one thing about this, the challenges, is that the application rate, it's greater than your typical ag sprayer. We're not applying 50 to 100 gallons per acre or less. We're applying 500 to 1,000 gallons per acre, so you can't use your typical ag sprayer. On the other hand, we're only putting on a quarter of an inch per acre. And this picture, you can see the dark spots. That's the spray pattern at one of the times that they were applying. So it's not a very heavy application, but that application was in the neighborhood of 700 pounds of BOD per acre. We apply that once a week over the course of April through October. Total application over the course of a season, we calculated if we could get the recovery that we wanted, which was about 30 to 40% of the applied glycol, would be about a quarter of an inch per acre. So we're really not talking about much volume. So we couldn't irrigate it because the application rate was so small, but we couldn't apply it with a standard spray spreader. So they customized a couple of an old deuce and a half with a tank and a hacksaw and some PVC and made some special nozzles that that work great, and they're a little more sophisticated now. But the thing is, a light application rate like that, you can see it's just barely scattered across the soil, and you need direct contact with the soil, because if there's a crop growing, it'll just get taken on, it's just intercepted by the leaves and won't make it to the soil and won't be reacted and won't be digested by the microbes in the soil. So we had to have bare soil, which was a little heartburn for the standard paradigm from the regulatory agency, because they believe that the soil is a sieve and you have to have a crop and that's the only treatment that you get from a land application system. The good news was the person who was working through the permitting process with us at the Department of Ecology, who was a former employee of ours who believed in the land application and understood the process and fought for us on our behalf and said, let's give it a try, because this is all vital work, which is why she said, adjust for the atmospheric pressure, cover everything that you possibly can, and then somebody will say yes, because you've covered it. Benzotriazoles tend to be toxic to leaves. There are triazoles that are herbicides. This is a corrosion inhibitor. I tried it on my lawn. I got some lawn leaf kill. The good news is benzotriazoles are incorporated into lignin as taken up by the plants from the soil. So we grow a crop, plant a dryland grain crop after the application is done in the late spring, and use the moisture that's been accumulated by the soil in our bare ground, and grow it, and then till it back into the soil, because it's not going to come up with a full yield that's going to be appropriate for any kind of harvest or use. Potential for molybdenum accumulation. Molybdenum is a micronutrient. It's necessary, but if it accumulates too much, it can be taken up by the plants and become a toxic toxin to certain ruminants. But the good news is it's a light application rate, and we're monitoring the soil for that. The high carbon load with no nitrogen load essentially was a problem for potential nitrogen deficiency. But we put together some soil testing as a before and after, and guidance for a nitrogen application to balance the application rate to about a 30-to-1 carbon to nitrogen ratio to give it just kind of a neutral carbon to nitrogen ratio. And so far they haven't had to add nitrogen. High sodium concentration and EC, that was another concern. But the light application rate and soil monitoring, we've still maintained a good soil quality. So you can put, it's all about the dose, not the concentration really. Petroleum hydrocarbons, that's another pollution concern. But again, the light application rate, and they're susceptible to microbial degradation. These are mostly in the motor oil range, no gasoline, a little bit of diesel range hydrocarbons, a little bit of motor oil range hydrocarbons. So the results, bland treatment began in September on 90 acres, and it's continued on 90 acres since the last total of 4 years. There's been no negative impact to groundwater. We've got 5 monitoring wells at the site, 2 up gradient and 1 cross gradient, 2 down gradient. The surprising thing was to see that when we first started monitoring, there's a little bit of detectable arsenic in the groundwater. It's just naturally occurring. So we got to make sure we documented that. We monitored for about a year before we started to apply. And there's high nitrate concentrations, so you know it's not anaerobic in the groundwater. There's been no COD overload and reducing conditions have not been detected. As a way to try to check for reducing conditions in the soil, we use the alfalfa dipyridyl dye test on the soil as we sample it before and after the application is finished. There's been no need for supplemental nitrogen. There's been plenty of this. This soil is unusual for a western soil. I mean, in the Midwest, 4% organic matter is pretty low. In the West, we're doing pretty good with 1.5. And this has got about 1.5% organic matter to 2 feet deep, which is just kind of strange, but there's plenty of nitrogen mineralization going on in that soil. There's been no accumulation of molybdenum. It's still at non-detect, and petroleum hydrocarbons, we test for that every twice a year, and that's not been detected. It's been decomposed. Finally, 436,000 gallons of recovered de-icer applied in the last 4 years, 78,000 gallons of propylene glycol in that 436 gallons of recovered de-icer. So that's the end.
Anybody have a question for Dan when we get Pierre set up on his presentation?
Yeah.
Where was the land where you applied it?
It's right next to the airport. Airports are land rich typically.
So the airport.
The airport owns the land. We looked at it and said, you got lots of land. They said, we got lots of land. We don't want to build a mechanical treatment system. I mean, we looked at all kinds of mechanical, anaerobic digestion, aerobic digestion, but you got to feed it nutrients, and then what do you do with the water? You got to put it somewhere. You put it back in the infiltration area and flood that all over again.
All right. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
So our next speaker is Pierre Bournet, and he's going to talk about the leadership roles for soil scientists in environmental consulting.
And I want to thank